Carolina.
No one puts it sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from The Eno Mill Village by Carolyn E. Norris, which appeared in Volume 2, Number 1 of the Hillsborough Historical Society's Journal, published in July 1999. The Eno Mill Village. The early days of Eno Cotton Mill. By the turn of the 20th century, industrialization was taking hold in Piedmont, North Carolina. Many cotton mills were being built along the rivers, commonly adjacent to railroad tracks. The Eno Cotton Mills, Incorporated, was chartered by a special act of the North Carolina General Assembly in 1896. Founders and principal stockholders were Allen J. Ruffin, first president, George A. Durham, first vice president, and James Webb, Jr., first secretary and treasurer. Construction of Eno Cotton Mill began in 1896 along the banks of the Eno River west of Hillsborough. Railroad tracks had been laid nearby in the late 1850s using ballast, the crushed rock or gravel that is placed between and below the ties of a railroad, mined from Okeechobee Mountain. The river provided the power source and the railroad provided the route of transport for the raw cotton into the mill and the yarn or cloth products away for distribution. Machinery was installed and the mill started operating in late 1897 as a 10,000 spindle yarn mill. At this time, throughout Piedmont, North Carolina, rural people who were struggling to make their living fled their farms and arrived at these river sites to work in the mills, to find a better life, to make a living to support their families. Workers for the Eno Cotton Mill came from rural sections of Orange, Alamance, and other neighboring counties. They worked in the mill or in other services and support in the mill. Back then, you know, the way people got started in these cotton mills, they were starving to death on farms. They couldn't make a living if you read history. They couldn't feed their families. When the industry started, they would leave their farms and come into work. They could put their children to work, their wives to work. That quote from a taped interview with Mary Lou Hicks and Valley Gerdeman, conducted by Carolyn Norris in 1994. Mr. Paul Riley, born in 1888 near Caldwell, remembers his family moving from the farm to work for the Eno Cotton Mill when he was about 15. His father worked for the Eno Mill Company store, delivering food and groceries around to the people in the mill village. When he first started working in the mill, they were making yarn. He worked in the twister room about 10 years, then left there to start his own meat market business in the mill village. In 1904, the mill expanded, and the first looms were installed for weaving cloth, ginghams and plaids. Miss Anna Dixon, who was born in 1895 in Alamance County, remembers moving with her family from a farm in the county to work in the Eno Mill. "I come here when I was 10 years old. When I come here, in 1905, they just put in the first looms in Eno Cotton Mill. The looms that they put in, my mama and daddy helped break them in, just starting them off. They were called Crompton looms, and they run ginghams, checkworks. It was a single-box loom, and there was a four-box loom, and there was a two-box loom, and they run different patterns. On the single-box loom, they had to run plain material, like chambray. And in them days, young'uns could stay in the mill with their parents. My parents went to work then at 6 o'clock of a morning and worked till 6 at night. Well, we had a colored woman here at the house first. She come with us from Hall River and kept house. And my mama and daddy was weaving, and about 8 o'clock I'd get up. And she'd have my breakfast ready, and I'd eat my breakfast and go to the mill. And I stayed down there with my mama and daddy, and I'd get tired. I'd watch them with their work till I got tired. When the mill stopped for December, a whole lot of the hands quit and left because the job was tough. and the boss weaver came to me when we started up from Christmas. I was 10 years old in May before that. And he comes in and he says, "Anna, don't you want to take a set of looms?" I said, "You'll have to ask my daddy." And he went on to Papa to talk to him. Papa said, "Why, she can't weave. We never showed her nothing. No, you can't put her on a loom." The boss weaver said, "I've been watching her helping you all. She can run a set of looms." 4 looms was a set for anybody just to learn, but 6 or 8 was a set for the regular weavers. Papa said, "Well, if you want to try on it, that's up to you and her." Well, he put me on a set of looms, and he got me a little box and gave it to me to stand on to draw in the end on the loom I couldn't reach. So I had to stand on that little box and go behind the loom and tie the thread where it had broke and throw it up on the harness and come back and get on my box and draw it in. Well, I run them 4 looms about 4 weeks, I think it was, and then they give me 6, until I didn't run them but a little while till they put me on 8. And so from that I didn't leave working in the weaving room ever since. I went on the payroll in December 1905. In the early days of the mill, women learned as children how to work. Mrs. Valley Gerdeman, who grew up in the mill village, recalls, "I don't think children got paid until they could produce. Granddaddy was teaching Mama to weave, and that gave him more production. But once she got proficient, the boss, he'd keep his eye on her, and he'd say, 'If you're going to stay down here, you might as well have your own.' But they probably didn't pay them as much. Mama said that Granddaddy took her check. Her daddy would take her paycheck when they paid off at the mill. They put it in a little envelope. She said she got to keep her first paycheck the weekend before she was married. When Mama worked there and her babies was born, they would let them leave the mill and go home and nurse the baby, and then they would go back to work. I think women more or less got started as children. A man would take his wife in, his family in. Everybody would go to work in the mill. Those girls grew up in the mill, and they just sort of stayed on. I believe that's how women first got into the workforce." Everyone remembers life in the mill village as a happy time, with people in the village very much like an extended family, helping each other out in times of need. No one had very much, but there was a very rich community life. The following recollections by various interviewees depict a variety of scenes from village life: neighbors, gardens and animals, music, swimming and fishing in the river, getting water from springs and hand pumps, children's games, the carnival coming to town, baseball, schools. Commenting on life in the mill village, Coy Andrews recalled, "I would say I spent a happy life over there. Always got along good with the people. We always pitched in at time of need and helped. It was a very good life. We didn't have nothing except plenty to eat." Neighbors were always borrowing from each other. They'd borrow an egg or a piece of fatback, maybe a couple of Irish potatoes. "I'd say we had a wonderful life. I wouldn't mind living it back over again." And neighbors would pitch in to help. "I'd rather have lived on the mountain 2 to 1 than over on this side. We had some good a neighbors than there was in the country. See, the head of the family got sick and out a week, and they was in trouble. Took all his pay to pay off every week. By the time they bought their groceries, they'd be broke. If he was out a week, they was in trouble. But these 2 old men would go to the rescue. They had a house full of young'uns, all of them working, and they'd carry on for them. Most people on the mountain would." The mill village residents brought a bit of farm life with them. They tended their gardens, took care of their animals. They did not keep their animals in their yard at their house. They kept them down in the river bottom land, where they also had their gardens. All that was cleaned out, and both sides of the mountains was cleaned up, and people had gardens down the river bank on this side of the river. We lived on the river road. Everyone had corn all along the river, the banks of the river and all, as far as you could get it. Anyone could plant it that wanted to. See, if you never been used to nothing, you didn't miss it. You take my wife's mother. After dinner in the summertime, she'd go pick blackberries or huckleberries. She was putting up something of the evening. I'd say half of the people raised their own meat on the hill. They had hogs. I had 4 good-sized hogs and 7 pigs. A cow, a milk cow. There was plenty to eat. There's a lot of people would go over and pick blackberries on the mountain. There were a lot of blackberries and dewberries and huckleberries. And they'd have a buckboard, and they'd put those fruit and vegetables in there, and they'd come by with a horse, and we'd buy vegetables if our garden wasn't producing. Back then, everyone had a garden and apples. The Mill Village people also hunted, primarily rabbit and squirrel, adding meat to their diet. The Mill Village people also made tonics and homegrown remedies. An asafoetida was one of the things that mill people used to put on their children, and the asafoetida was similar to garlic, I think. I don't know where they got the asafoetida, but they put it in little bags, hang it around our neck, and that was to ward off all the colds. And that warded off all friends and neighbors and everything. So I was supposed to wear it in the winter time, and I would take it off and hide it behind a rock on the way to school. And on the way home, I'd put it back on to make Grandma happy. And in the spring, the people from the mill village would come over, and they'd have herb council up on the bank behind our house, and they'd make a spring tonic, and they would boil it and do whatever they did with it. And that was the spring tonic, and we would drink that. Sassafras tea was another spring tonic, and ginseng. I don't guess there's any ginseng that grows there anymore. About children's games, Bryant Davis recalls, "We had fun. We had street lights. We had sidewalks, you know, in front of all these mill houses. We had sidewalks all the way around. We would play all night, and we would play hide and seek, and then we would play whistle and hide. You would hide, and somebody would whistle, and you would try to find them. Just a gang of us out on the street. But 9 o'clock, you knew to go in the house, because when Daddy said, 'Come in,' you better come. And we'd play hopscotch, and we'd shoot marbles, play ball in the front yard. Daddy had our yard fenced in, and we had a big old collie dog stayed with us. To play ball, children would find a hard rock and make their ball by wrapping layers and layers of mill yarn around it. Children would also fashion their own seesaws using scrap lumber. Doris King Grimsley, who was born in 1922, lived in the mountain village and remembers, "We would skate from the top of the mountain. We had sidewalks all the way down, and we'd get going a little too fast. We'd run off into the grass to slow down, stop ourselves. It was all the way downhill like that till the front row down there next to the river. That's where we went to skate, on the flat part down there. My mother wouldn't let us go skating or do anything till we got our chores done, washing dishes, sweeping, getting in wood. Then I'd put my skates on and go down 12 flights of stairs with them on. I could do it. It won't nothing, 'cause I was so used to them. I stayed on them about all the time. Up on the peak of the mountain we had a big tree, and we had swings in it. The workers got the rope from the mill. They gave it to 'em. They built runarounds. A runaround is a rope that's tied on a tree way up high, and it's on a hill, and you get on it. You got a little seat where it's tied together, and then you hold on it, too. You get a good running start, and you leave the ground. I imagine we were higher than any building in Hillsboro. Even people off of the hill would come over there and swing on them swings. I begged them to carry me over there during lunchtime. They'd come home from the mill at lunch. I'd say, 'Please carry me up and let me swing one time before you go back to work.' And they would. Oh, I loved those swings. Those were good days, I'm telling you." The entire mill village came alive when the carnival came to town. "When the circus came to town, we called it a carnival. We had popcorn and cotton candy. They would lead the elephants. The animals had to be watered. So they'd lead the animals down to the creek. What big excitement that was. And they'd come from the Eno Mill and Bellevue Mill. All the kids around and their families would come and watch the elephants go down to water. It was really fun to watch all that come into town. Oh, yes, we got to go to the carnival. That was big excitement. Then, in the bottom, we called it Monkey Bottom because of some of the monkeys got away and set up housekeeping down there in the bottom. There was swings and a Ferris wheel, and they had a merry-go-round. More or less, we just got to see the animals. They didn't perform all that much. It was exciting. There were sideshows. They had the giant. And for years, and I guess that ring may still be around somewhere, Daddy got a ring that belonged to a giant." Hazel Parker was born in 1914 in the barracks of the old military academy. Both of her parents were weavers in the mill. She talked about the schools. "The old barracks up there, it was a military school. I was born in that. They quit having the military school. At that time, people were poor and didn't have anything much. They rented out rooms in there. My mother and Daddy, we didn't stay in it long, but that was where I was born." She recalls attending school in the mill village. "They had a little school across from the mill down there. It was across the railroad. It was a wooden school. It was two-story, but it didn't have but two grades. They called it high first and low first, and then high second and low second. And that's where me and my older brother started school. And then after we got through second grade, they sent us to town to the Hillsboro High School uptown. That's where we finished school. And she'd walk to the Hillsboro High School uptown. I'd meet some of the girls down on the railroad from our house. We'd get on the railroad, 'cause it wouldn't be as muddy if it was bad weather, and walk to West Hillsboro, where the depot used to be down there, and Kate's store. And Mr. Cates would be down there. And he had a big old coal stove, and he'd have it burning when we got that far. As the number of mill workers grew, mill houses were built until an entire mill village was established. Bryant Davis recalls, "I counted it up one time. There was well over 100 houses in the mill village." Over a period of time, four sections were built: Front Row, Old Hill, New Hill, and the Mountain Village. Basically, the mill village was divided into four different sections. Starting at the mill and working back to the west, the mill village ran along Dimmock's Mill Road and facing Southern Railway. We had what we call Front Row that started to the west side of the mill, basically four rows of houses. From the mill all the way back to New Hill, the last row of houses next to the river was all two-room houses, except maybe one three-room house. It was called Two-Room Row. People with small families or no kids lived here. By the time they moved out, they had three or four children. And then we had a road that we called Doherty's Hill. That was the name of it then, because Ed Doherty lived on top of the hill. Then, as we came west along Dimmock's Mill Road, was what was known as Old Hill. It consisted of five rows of houses, also with the dirt road winding through them. Then, going west again, was what was known as New Hill, and this was because these were the last houses built, so they were the newer ones. Again, it had five rows of houses. Each house had an outhouse. Everybody that lived in any of these houses had to work in the mill. This road went around and went across Eno River to what was known as the Mountain Village. It had five rows of houses with the road winding through them and dead-ended just above the last row of houses. And then to the west of these was two rows of houses that went in the direction of the base of Eno Mountain. And, of course, at the end of these houses, below the base of Eno Mountain, was the mill trash pile. In 1906, non-denominational services were held on the second floor of the brick building that housed the company store. That year, a Methodist minister from Durham, Reverend E. M. Hoyle, was invited to preach a revival and led the congregation to organize. Mr. Alan Ruffin, mill president, donated a small piece of ground on the north side of Eno Street. In the summer of 1908, the present frame structure for Eno Methodist Church was completed and became the church building. At that time, it was a one-room building and was used for educational purposes as well as worship. In the early days of the church, the mill helped pay the preacher's salary. In the 1920s, additional classrooms were added to the back part of the building. In 1938, the church building was remodeled and moved to the rear of the lot. In 1940, the church had over 140 members. Besides the company store, a few local stores catered to the mill village. Paul Riley's son would walk 15 miles out into the country to buy a cow from a farmer, then walk it back into town to his father's meat market to butcher. People didn't really get much fresh meat unless they got it at the market, because there wasn't any refrigeration. I can remember when you used to butcher a cow, you'd get all the kids, and you'd say, "Go home and tell your mammy, I've got some fresh stew beef now." Here you'd go home and tell them, and here they'd come. And you'd sell it just about as soon as you had it cut up, didn't you? You remember grinding that hamburger? What a job that was, that old hand grinder. Sometimes I've seen two or three standing here trying to pull on that thing to grind that meat. Edith Brewer remembers Mr. Charlie Riley's store. "I can see Mr. Riley right now in his store. He had his molasses in a 50-gallon barrel, and it had a handle on it with a spigot on it. You'd take your quart jar and get it full of molasses, and the cheese lay there in a hoop, a wooden hoop, and he'd raise that lid up and cut you off as much cheese as you wanted, half pound, pound. He had a whole bunch of bananas hanging up by a string, by their stalk on a string. Mr. Riley sold a lot of different things. They had clothes, overalls. We didn't have to worry about going into town for anything. I guess you could buy a whole week's groceries for $3 or $4, and you could buy enough flour and meat and beans and stuff for your week. The mill had their own power. They had a big coal pile in the back a lot down at the mill, and you'd buy a 50-pound bag of coal. Now, you bought a ton, a big truck carried it to your house, and they take so much each week out of your paycheck. Instead of us having a country store, it was all operated through the mill. A row of stores, and even a theater, was located at West End. You didn't have to worry about anything. There was a grocery store, a hardware store, a barber shop, and a cafe. That was in a line. The other grocery store that set up here by itself, it was a big grocery store. Mr. Murray ran that one. We had a nice drug store once. Mr. Cates had a dry goods store with everything. A theater. At one time, a big discount place and cafe there. And a barber shop. We didn't have to go to Hillsboro for anything. I don't guess I went to Hillsboro till I was 16 years old. Old Mr. Joe Murray built that store, and it must have been class in its day. You've seen these stores with these ceilings in them, and it looked like it was some kind of metal or tin, little designs in the ceilings. That had that in the ceiling. And I mean the showcases in that thing were all glass showcases. They were pretty across the middle of that floor, and the counters were nice-looking counters. And a big old cash register, the crank type. And they had a big old heater sitting in the middle of the store. That's what they heated the store with. Great big black thing. My grandfather gave me $1 for my birthday, and jawbreakers were just coming into being. So I went up to Mr. Buck Murray's store and bought $1's worth of jawbreakers. At that time, they were 3 for a penny. My mother was, needless to say, hostile when she found out that Mr. Buck Murray had sold me that many jawbreakers. Bryant Davis remembers the store on New Hill. As I was growing up, there were not many cars on our end of town, in particular. So we had one store at the Mill Village on New Hill that, basically, we called the community store. It was run by Mr. and Mrs. Williams when I first remember it. Then, of course, it changed hands 2 or 3 times from there. And when the Mill Village broke up, Mr. and Mrs. Brooks were running it. Most of the people would buy from this store because it was handy. Back then, you could either go to the store and order your groceries and take them home with you, or you could write out your list and give it to the storekeeper, and they would fill the order sometime during the day and bring it to you. In the early days, the stores delivered groceries with a horse and wagon. In later years, they used an old truck to deliver groceries. In addition to the local stores, some Mill Village residents operated a little junk stand on their back porch, selling Coca-Colas and candy. My brother Bill King ran a store up under his house, his front porch. It was so tall. He had everything in it. He lived way down on the front row. A lot of people run stores. Us kids, we'd buy candy and junk. That's all we bought. Old Mr. Riddles, he was a good man. He would take a box, fix it around his neck, and it'd be full of candy. And he'd come around and give us young'uns on the mountain candy. He'd sell it or give it to us. And there were traveling salesmen. We'd buy cloth from Mr. Kimry. He'd come around in an old T-model Ford from Orange Grove. Him and his daughter come around every Saturday. He had cloth. He had penny candy. He couldn't even get his T-model stopped for us young'uns. We could hardly wait for him to get on that mountain. After the 3 o'clock whistle blew at the mill, first shift mill workers would congregate at the local stores. Local checker players could be found huddled around their checkerboards in the large window seats in the front of these stores, challenging local route salesmen. The passenger railroad station in West Hillsboro provided a link with the rest of the world. The railroad track was a lifeline. It brought coal for us to keep warm, lumber for us to build, necessary things from other states. There was a station. People would take the train to Durham, to Greensboro. That was a big deal, taking the train to Durham. And they burnt coal. So when you washed your clothes and you hung them out, the coal cinders, we thought it was because the cinders were hot, but it wasn't. It was just the acid that was burning holes in your clothes. If the birds didn't get them, the train cinders did. In response to further market changes, the mill was converted in 1950 to the production of corduroy. In 1952, Eno Cotton Mills Incorporated was merged into Cone Mills Corporation and became Eno Plant. In early March of 1956, Cone Mills Corporation announced the dispersal of the mill village. The 150 homes owned by the company were sold to employees, who moved them to their own sites off of the company property. The purchase price was set at $25 per room, and employees were given plenty of time to locate a piece of land and move them away. Families currently living in the houses were given first choice in purchasing these homes. Houses not sold under that agreement were made available to other employees, and later to the general public. At the time the mill village broke up, the houses were sold for $25 a room, and the employee had to move them off of the lot. When the employees were living in the houses, their lights went with their house, and it cost $1.25 a week for lights and rent, and it was taken out of their check. When they started selling the houses, they had a gentleman that came in from Tennessee. Guyton, I believe was his name, came in with flatbed trucks, and they had cross ties like you use on the railroads. They would jack the houses up, cause some of the houses, the way the terrain was, maybe one end of the house, the front or the back, would be basically on the ground, and the other end would be 5 to 6 feet off the ground, and the houses set on pillars. The houses were not underpinned, so they would jack it up far enough and scotch it with the railroad ties until they could get these long steel I-beams under them, and then they'd jack up the steel I-beams till they got it high enough, till they could back the flatbed truck up under it, and then let the house down on the truck and haul it to the new location. Of course, they had to tear out the chimneys before they did this, because the chimney ran up the center of the houses. It was a great big flatbed truck, and they rolled the house up onto it with metal rods. Then they came across that little Shackleton bridge. They had to get them above the railings on the bridge in order to bring them across. They would have to jack the house up onto the truck. As soon as they got across the river, they'd have to lower the house and bring it down so they could get underneath the power lines. The Eno plant closed in 1984. Today, on Okinichi Mountain, or along the banks of the Eno near the old cotton mill, only a few remnants of this former mill village life can be found. If you know where to look, you may stumble onto old sidewalk, or see plantings that have survived from an old garden. The houses that were moved from the mountain in 1956 are now dispersed in various parts of West Hillsboro and its environs. Part of the property where the Mountain Mill Village was located is now public park. The town of Hillsboro owns 29 acres on Okinichi Mountain, and adjacent acreage has been incorporated into the Eno River State Park system. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
If I had a land and time for only a day, I'd make a wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.